Music session number 18836, Reel 2.
This is Hal Kerridge, Reel 2.
Well, this is where the second shock came in. We were tough young lads in those days. We'd been all through our training and we were tough. But what we didn't expect was what we faced when we got into France. We were taken to a camp of some sort in Etaps, and we were told to dump our gear in some huts, not huts, in some tents that were there, and then fall in for a meal, which we did. And we went and had our meal, and we came back again to put our kit on to go someplace else, and no sooner you put your kit on, you start this sort of thing. I thought, God almighty. And I looked and found I was lousy. And my kit had only been in there a couple of hours while I had a meal in the sand at Etaps. And from that day on to the day I came home, I was lousy from head to foot. And imagine the feelings of a decently brought up youngster, not only me, but hundreds more like me, to be suddenly faced with that. And when I say they were lice, they were real lice. They weren't fleas. They were damn great big things. And they were like that day and night. But there again, you got used to it. Everybody else was like it. So you accepted it. It was part of your life. There's no getting away from it, no getting out of it. You were just lousy. I don't think we're any worse off wearing a kilt than anything else, because you got all in them, the pleats of a kilt, got all in the seams of your shirts and that sort of thing. A little later on, in the so-called trenches, because there were no trenches as you know them, they're all blown to bits, so it was just something holes in the ground. But it was on perhaps a nice sunny day in the summer, when there was no bombardment going on, you'd see a line of fellas sitting in a so-called trench, not a smile on their faces, just like a lot of ladies doing their knitting, sitting there doing this all the time, killing lice. Not a smile on their faces. It was just a normal occupation. And that's how we lived.
How soon were you sent to the front, having arrived at Etap?
How soon did we go up line? My regiment, the London Scots, were out on rest at the time, so they'd been out about a week. And I joined them, I think, when they were just about due to go back up the line. And it was then that we had a shock. Because we assembled one morning, as is normal, and we were told to... I forget the exact words now. It was a sergeant or a sergeant major took over. He said, the following people will stand firm. The rest will be dismissed. And there was about, I don't know, it was a dozen or 15 or 16 of us named, and I was one of the names. And I thought, well, what the hell have I done? What's all of this in aid of? Anyway, we stood firm and the rest of them were dismissed. We were called together and said, you crowd are transferred to the Gordon Highlanders. Now, we really formed our own conclusions on this. We rightly or wrongly, I don't know. But the Gordon Highlanders were in training then. We found this out afterwards. The Gordon Highlanders were in training then for something that had never been done before. That was a major attack with a full bombardment in the middle of the night. Because most attacks were in daytime. We can see where you're going. And we assumed, and this is only an assumption, that one of the ration parties or something like that had stopped a big German shell on the way out, taking rations up overnight, and they had more or less decimated the whole platoon. And we were suddenly called in there to make up the number for the big attack that was coming. And that's only an assumption. But I don't think that I was far out, or we were far out. So that is why and how we joined the Gordon Highlanders. And there was only, as I say, a handful of us. There was only a dozen, 15, 16 or something like that. And there was we Londoners pitchforked amongst the real Scots. But I give them full credit, God bless them. They're great lads. They accepted us.
Where did you join them? What, were they in the same area of Etop?
No. They were, I forget now, I think we got a train to somewhere. They were a bit further along the line, I think. We joined them. Where the hell was it now? We joined them a little bit further south. And I think they were a bit further up near the Belgian frontier. In fact, I know they were. Because we joined them at a village spelt the English way, Hinges, H-I-N-G-E-S, which I suppose in France was Angers. And that was not very far from Bethune. And that's where we joined the Gordon Highlanders. And as I say, the grand chaps that they were, rough and really old lads, mind you, but they accepted us and that was that. And that's where I finished my fighting career, with the Gordon Highlanders, not with the London Scottish. When I was demobbed, I did raise this point, actually, with, I forget who it was now, some pipped officer, because I was only a private, some officer in the Gordons. I said, well, what happens to us? I said, we only join the London Scottish as territorials for the duration of the war. We are now with the regular army. What happens to us when the war is over? Are we kept in the regular army or what? He said, oh, no. No, he said, if you go back to England, whether you go back wounded or whether you go back demobbed, you go back to your territorial status. So that's what we did, and I was demobbed as a territorial.
So what was your first experience up the line, Hal? Do you remember that?
Well, it's one of those things that it grows on you, because the nearer you get to the front line, the more you hear of the guns. The first time you hear the guns, you say, oh, they're somewhere away yet, but they get louder and louder as you get nearer and nearer, until you find the damn things are flying over your head. Of course, everybody is terrified. Everybody. Particularly so when you got orders to go over the top. Everybody was terrified. But you never showed it. You hoped you never showed it, because you looked at the other fellows all around you and they just nonchalant about it. So you thought, well, it's ordinary, I suppose. So you ignored it. You were nonchalant just as they were. So nobody ever showed fear at all. You knew what was coming. You knew your chances were 60-40 against you. You were either killed or you were badly maimed. But that was a soldier's life. I mean, when you join the army to be taught to kill. And that was it.
What were the stages of going over the top? You know, when you were going into an operation, the standing to and the rest of it. Do you remember that first occasion?
Well, I remember, yes. I remember. Well, there were a series of it. You see, you had night patrols every night. And that was a night patrol, was usually in the hands of a sergeant or somebody like that. and he had a couple of bods with him, and the general idea was to creep about in no man's land and get as near the German trench as you could, find out what they were doing, take a prisoner if you could, and bring him back again. That was a very dodgy effort. So messing about in no man's land was a sort of, if it was your duty, was a normal thing. But on a major attack, it was a different thing entirely, because you started off with a tremendous bombardment. And as I said, normally, that's always done at daylight, where you know what you're doing and you see where you're going. But in this particular case, it had never been tried before. They had a full creeping barrage in the middle of the night. The barrage stopped. The infantry went over. The barrage lifted onto the German lines, the second lines, to keep them pushing them further back so the infantry could go forward. And it was utter chaos. Well, you never know whether it was your own guns or whose guns it was throwing all the metal about. And bullets flying everywhere. Of course, it was a hail of metal everywhere. And if you came through it, you were dead lucky.
And you obviously came through that first.
I got hit.
You were hit, were you?
Oh, yes, I got hit in that, yes. I got within about, I can only guess, 10, 15 yards of the German lines, because I could hear all the shouting and bawling going on and that sort of thing. And I knew I was hit. There's various stages of it. It's something like with a red hot poker shoving in your back. I got hit in the back. Just say it hurts. It didn't hurt all that much, but it just like a red hot poker being shoved in your back. And of course, you would go down immediately. And as it's in your back, you couldn't do anything. You've got a field dressing, but you can't see where it is. You can't see how bad it is. You put your hand behind you, and when it comes out covered in blood, you say, you know you've been hit all right. So the first thing is try and get back to your own lines. And you find your arms are working and your legs are working, and you start trying to creep back to your own lines again until somebody picks you up and gives you a hand. And that's how I finished. From then onwards, I got transferred to a casualty clearance station. They did what they could and patched me up and that sort of thing, and then I was sent down to base hospital. And it was from base hospital that I came home for debug, because I was no longer an A1 fit man.
That would have been in 1918.
That would have been in 1918, because when we went over the top in the middle of the night, as I told you, we were straightening out a very dodgy part of the line on the Labassie Canal, which we had to secure before the main thrust could go forward to push the Germans back to their own country. And that was really the commencement of the final battle that shoved the Germans back to their own country. And I would have liked to have gone back with the Army of Occupation in some ways. But in other ways, I was glad to get out of it and go back to base hospital. I was fortunate in a way that I could make myself very useful there, because I was articulate and I could write and I could read, and which a lot of them couldn't do because they'd lost hands or lack of education or what have you. So I used to write letters for some of the lads who couldn't write at all, write home and that sort of thing. And the nurses got hold of me and they found I was useful tramping around the wards doing this, that and the other. And I gradually drifted about down there and was still as a C3 man or an A1 man. I couldn't rejoin the battalion.
Yes, that you say was the first night attack, is that right? That particular one.
It was the first night attack. It was a very, very dodgy enterprise. It had never been done before.
Was there much planning for it and preparation?
I suppose there was a good deal of planning in the high-ups. The extent of the operation would be about 3 miles wide. And we weren't, the Gordons weren't the only ones. I mean, there were other battalions there. I think there was some Suffolks and somebody else there. I didn't know anything about them. All you knew was the little bit in front of you That's as far as you could see, that much. What's happening on the other side, you wouldn't know. All you see. And you must remember then that it wasn't like going over the fields in England. That had been no man's land for 2 years. And it was just a mass of potholes, mud. And if you fell over in that lot, you got drowned in mud. Literally drowned in mud. Unless you've got somebody there to pull you out. So making your way forward was no easy matter, especially in the dark. You didn't know where you were going. You could only go by the memory of what you could see in front of you. You could say, well, there's a bit of a church over there. That was all that's left of it. And there were some trees over there. All that's left of those are some stumps. So if I can keep between the trees and that, that's sort of more or less straight.
What was your particular objective, your own? Were you given a special job during that operation? What had you to do?
Kill Germans. That's all. Clear them out of their own trenches and push them back. Which we did. When I say we, I can only speak now of the whole crowd that went over that night. Yes, we pushed them all back that night. When I say we, I wasn't there because I was already wounded. We took about 200 or 300 prisoners that night. Took about 40 or 50 machine guns and got the Germans on the run. And a pathetic lot they were. They were the dregs. They were the last of the call up of the Germans. They were literally like young boys of 15, half of them did. Terrified. We got them on the run, and obviously they left everything. They left their guns and everything and shut off back.
When you were hit, you know, you explained so well it was dark and you didn't know exactly where or what had happened. Was that a very worrying experience, you know, knowing how severe you were and getting back to behind?
Terribly worrying. It was terribly worrying because you didn't know how badly you were hit. You didn't know whether the attack had been successful or whether you had been repulsed. And if the Germans had repulsed and attacked on top of their own attack and shoved us back, and they found you lying in no man's land, the chances were you got another bullet or you got a bayonet. And that was the end of that. So your main objective was to get out of it as quickly as you could, trying to ignore whatever wounds you've got at the back of you because you couldn't see.
Were you hindered by barbed wire at all?
Yes, to my knowledge, I was indeed. It was my own fault, pure and simple, because in the attack, we had to cut the barbed wire to get on the right side of it before we made the attack. You can't attack from behind the barbed wire, you've got to get in front of it. So we made gaps in the barbed wire and we got in front of it all right. And I'd forgotten all about, in the anxiety I suppose, I'd forgotten all about trip wires and that sort of thing in front of the barbed wire. And when I got within hearing distance of our own trenches, I suppose it was a normal reaction. I must have said to myself, well, thank God for that. And I got up and staggered forward as far as I possibly could, caught my foot in the tripwire and took head first into the barbed wire. And I cut myself to pieces. That was on top of the wounds. But it was all part of the business.
How did you get to the casualty clearing station? Were you taken by stretcher?
Yes. When I got almost within our own lines, a couple of fellows picked me up. I don't know who they were, whether they were medical orderlies or what they were. They picked me up and helped me along to our trenches and shoved me on the stretcher there. And then they took me back to what they called a casualty clearing station. And that was very haphazard. They gave you a slap on dressing sort of thing. To see how badly you were hit and whether you could do this, that, or the other. And that's what happened there. I got the casualty clearance station. And I don't know whether they were just medics or whether they were doctors or what they were, but a couple of them started fiddling around. They put me over a, what to me looked like a trestle. And they started playing around in the back there, which hurt like hell. Evidently, they got out whatever was in there, and I don't know to this day whether it was a lump of shrapnel or whether it was a bullet. Because, they, I mean, they were busy all the time. There were dozens of them waiting to be done. So they got busy on there and put a heavy dressing on it and that sort of thing. And from then onwards, I was bundled onto a... I have an idea. It was a... They had one or two old Crossley lorries out there that had been converted into a sort of an ambulance. They were solid tyres and all that nonsense, because a motor car had only just been invented. And I think I was slapped on that and taken a little way back again and then transferred to what had once been known as a charabang. And the charabang thing took us down to the base hospital.
And was the treatment good there? You know, did you have good facilities?
Marvellous. Rough and ready. But then it was as best they knew. I mean, they hadn't got the medical knowledge they have today. Oh, there's no anaesthetics or anything like that. You know, you had to scream your heart out and that was that.
I expect you saw some pretty pathetic cases, didn't you, Hal?
Dreadful, dreadful. But you got used to it.
Did you?
You got hardened. Well, it's like nurses, you see, bless their hearts. They must see some horrible sights in hospital, but they get used to it. And we get used to it in the battlefield. You see lumps and bits and pieces lying around and that sort of thing, and just too bad.
What experience had you had up until then? Because after all, this is the end of the war, isn't it, 1918? And you went out in 1916. Were you at the Somme battle at all?
No, I missed all the... I missed Passchendaele. My crowd were not in that. No, we were in and out of the front line on this, that and the other on various operations, but the big operations like Passchendaele were all formulated to throw the Germans back, and we didn't. They threw us back instead. So I missed that lot. If it had been July the 1st, I wouldn't have been here. It was July the 1st, they just mowed our crowd down like nothing. And you know, from that day to this, from my mob day, I've been all over the continent. I've been to France umpteen times. I have never been back to northern France and never want to go back. I've been all over France, down the southern part of France. I've toured France. It would... No, it wouldn't be the same. I mean, what I remember of northern France, of course, which was the French industrial area at one time, and by the nature of things, water always finds its own level. So you've got the River Somme there, and you've got the canals there, which are all connected up with the River Somme. And you've got all the water supplies, like the houses and what have you, all underground, blown to pieces. So the whole land there was swampland. And that's why I say, if you went over there and then, it was a sea of mud. Huge craters full of mud, liquid mud. And that's how I would remember the Somme. And if I went back there now, I should see the same as I see here. I see lovely green fields, pretty little villages. And there wouldn't be the Somme, not to me. All I could see over there now would be lines and lines and lines of crosses. So I never wanted to go back, and I never will go back.
Well, you were in that area the whole time, were you? From 1916
yes,
to 1918?
Drifting up and down, right away from almost from the Belgian border. wherever the battalion was sent. As I say, the Scottish we were always in demand for this, that or the other. And we drifted along the line there right the way through down as far as, well, down past Bethune, right down to, almost down to Shattaferry. Up and down the line, sometimes you go out, sometimes you get a break for a fortnight where you get into reserves or something like that, and the battalion shifted to another part of the line. So you do get a change of scenery, if you like to call it such.
What were your dugouts like? You know, you've explained about this awful mud, but you know, where did you keep at night, you know, when you could get sleep?
In the mud. We never had any dugouts. The French had originally made dugouts in the early days of the war, but that was when France were in northern France. Directly we went over there, they shoot off down south, got out of it, and left us to it. And the only dugouts that were there were, of course, taken over by the Germans. We never saw any dugouts at all. Not a one, not single one. So, no, we just slept where we fell. In the so-called trenches that had once been a proper Kibetan trench but had been blown to bits and just got a bit of a firing step there, and that's about all. No, I was looking at it now as a farce to go over there and see a lovely clean trench with nice clean duck boards at the bottom, nice clean firing step to stand on. No, it's not the song that I knew. So I've never wanted to go back, and I never will. Well, I shan't go back now, not in my time of life.
But how did you manage for food when you were up in the line? You know, in these terribly muddy conditions.
Food?
Food.
Well, you always got your iron rations with you. That was bully beef and biscuits, of course. And that's about as much as you would get in the line. Rations used to come up at night time, of course, with the old horses and vans. You could hear the horses and vans in the German lines. The same as they could hear us, we could hear them. So it was quite a regular thing. And if you could hear them, you tell the gunners to open up and try and blow them to bits. But they did try and give us a hot meal once in a way of a sort. So really speaking, you lived on hard tack while you were in the front line and slightly better tack when you were in reserves, where the cooks could get down to cooking a meal.
How about rum? Did you have rum ration?
Never saw it.
One would have thought whiskey with the Scots. Did you ever see that? No whiskey?
No. That's the first greeting I think I had from the Gordon Highlanders. When the chappy came out and said, "Have you got a wee bit of rum in your bottle, Jock?" And they expected I might have a bottle full of whiskey and just a bottle full of water. We were London Scots. We were not Edinburgh or Glasgow. They probably carried a whole host of it.
How about cigarettes? Did you smoke at all in the... Did you smoke?
Yes, I did. Yes, I smoked till about 40 years ago, and I gave it up.
Did that help when you were in the trenches, to have a cigarette?
Yes, everybody smoked. Everyone. And you did in hospital, everybody. The first thing they did, even if you were wounded, the first thing they did is shove a cigarette in your mouth. It was a sort of a sedative. Oh, yes, everybody smoked. I was never a fierce smoker. It never bothered me all to that extent. I was never a heavy drinker, ever.